The Guardian.
Nicholson Baker is not an author who likes to repeat himself. Having established his reputation with two novels, The Mezzanine and Room Temperature, which tell the stories respectively of one man's lunch hour and 20 minutes spent feeding a baby with an exquisitely lavish eye for minute details, he then moved on to brazenly erotic fiction with The Fermata and Vox. His next book was for children, The Everlasting Story of Nori. And then, after a long hiatus, he produced two more novels and one impassioned polemic about the destruction of library archives, Double Fold. None of which would have led anybody to expect his latest book, an eccentric and provocative excursion into history, Human Smoke, which is a provocative account of the first years of the Second World War leading up to Pearl Harbor. When he visited the Guardian's podcast studio, I asked him what had led him to write such a very different book.
Well, it's different in that it's about a huge subject. You could say that in a way, I've always liked to write about subjects that are ordinary. I want to take things that are very, very familiar and try to look at them in a slightly different way or something. So a guy on his lunch hour or people having sex or something. Very ordinary subjects. This is probably the most written about war in the history of writing. So yeah. Is there a new way to talk about it? A new form you can give it? That's the first question.
Right. And what was your inspiration? Was there certain experiences or bits of reading that led you to this material, other than a general wish to make things new, as it were?
Yeah, it's the beginning of it. One of the beginnings was that I had a large newspaper collection from the British Library, these big bound volumes, heavy, beautiful things, and I would page through them, and I noticed that there were a lot of odd kind of revelations that were there. They're obviously part of the published record. Anyone can have read them from the day of publication on, but they haven't really been part of the standard account.
Narrative, yeah. Consensus, understanding.
So that was the beginning of it. And also there was an unhappiness about the current war that contributed to the puzzlement. And then I was in the middle of writing a book about a smaller subject, the Library of Congress, which was comprehensively militarized during the Second World War. It became an intelligence center in Washington. And then during the Cold War, there was a floor devoted to bomb targeting, actually, in a building of the Library of Congress, and I was writing a book about that, and then realized that I had to back up and really understand the Second World War, because it so completely changed Washington and changed the world, truly, but changed the way America functioned as an economy and as a militarized the whole country. So how did that all begin was the question.
And because the book, I mean, talking about both Iraq and the militarization of America, the subtitle of the book is The End of Civilization. Was that what you were thinking about by using that subtitle?
Well, obviously we're civilized people and we're here and nothing is being reduced to rubble around us. No people are being rounded up. So civilization didn't end in that most fundamental sense. But what I was shooting for with the subtitle was just the feeling, if you were in London in May of 1941, seeing the greatest city in the world burn, or if you were in Warsaw, seeing people just lying dead on the streets, or in the United States, actually, just reading about it in the paper, it felt as if this was a universal disaster, that this felt like a kind of suspension of all normal rules of civilized restraint.
In a way that most sort of grand conflicts would have felt the same. This is another end of the world or end of civilization.
But this one is more universal. I mean, I think I quoted someone as saying that if Japan comes into the war, that civilization will go up in flames. I think that the feeling that Stefan Zweig in particular wrote about, he's writing a letter, a New Year's letter to a friend right at the end of the book. Stefan Zweig, a wonderful German novelist and biographer, probably the best-selling German writer in the interwar period, although now much less known, and was made a pacifist by his experiences of the First World War, and was deeply depressed by what was happening, and had escaped to Brazil. And he said his pen trembled over the page as he realized that the spreading of the war into the Pacific was the greatest catastrophe that had ever happened. And that was the feeling that I wanted to get to that point, the end of 1941, and we're standing at the edge of a cliff.
People who know you for what's generally a very luxurious kind of prose style will be, again, surprised by this, because it's very restrained and neutral kind of writing that you bring to this book. Why did that seem appropriate?
Because if you read a lot of someone like Winston Churchill, a master of language, and yet know that the man was using language to cloak acts that were really very disturbing, it actually inhibits one's own prose style, I find. It turned out this way. It turned out very crisp and controlled and tamped down.
So this was an allergic reaction to Churchillian rhetoric.
To all the misuses of language, the Victor Klemperer, the diarist in Dresden, was at this point a very lovable man and a wonderful observer, was recording all the ways that language becomes distorted in a dictatorship. And over and over again, I would see that I would read a Rooseveltian speech, brilliant, beautifully written speech, measured about the four freedoms, and then think of what was actually happening behind it. And I wanted my own language to be just a kind of a tin plate, and then have the words that the voices, some of whom are inspiring, and some of whom are deeply disturbing, be the thing that I'm offering, rather than myself. I pulled myself out of the book because, out of respect, I think, for the really horribleness of what I'm writing about.
Yes, and in another way, you've drawn back from the foreground of the book is that it's a sequence of incidents from news reports and diaries and letters. It's a sequence of incidents, but there is no thread of commentary or argument putting it together. Again, I wonder why that seemed the appropriate line. Is that something to do with avoiding rhetoric as well?
Well, you know, there are 50 million books that have an argument about the Second World War and pull you through beautifully. And they're filled with these nice transition sentences in which it says, and Churchill was not without his critics, however, and then you have a nice potted account of the criticisms. But it isn't the way life actually is. What it is that someone makes a decision on a Tuesday to stand up in Parliament and say, when you said that there are 70 million malignant Huns and some of them are curable and some of them are killable, that sounds like what Hitler is saying about the Jews or something like that. A person decides to say something like that. That's the moment. And it's, in a sense, a story, a very short story. And that, I think, is a truer way of telling this bigger story.
It's a way of accessing the grain of events as they were experienced.
Yeah.
But it does also, because of the details you've and the individual stories you've selected, mm-hmm. build up. There is a kind of actually a polemical aspect of the book. The effect of that is because you've chosen to point to a radically different understanding of mm-hmm. the war to the one we're used to.
I think pointing to it is maybe the right way to put it. In that, I don't want to insist on it. I want to say that given these particular broken fragments in this constellation that I've put together, sort of like a documentary filmmaker who obviously has a point of view, who wants to supplement the existing notions of something with a different account, will arrange things. But I don't want to say you must believe, you must look at the war the way I've come to look at it, but simply that this, because there are lots and lots of little stories and space breaks, there, you just take the ones that seem memorable to you and you add them into your working knowledge of the war, is the way I look at it. It's not an attempt to convince, but simply to offer some uncomfortable complications.
Right. And it's still possible for somebody who disagrees with you to read very interesting and disturbing facts against the grain of what you think. Churchill, in particular, who is a national figurehead, maybe not so much to Guardian readers, but generally comes off extremely badly in this book as an anti-Semitic warrior with a sort of careless bloodlust.
I hope, though, that in presenting Hitler, in presenting Hitler as the evil and Churchill as the countervailing force, and then saying, but Churchill was in some ways, as you said, a very a bloodthirst, as his wife said, I think with this unnatural laughter at some point, he's making a little joke, and she says, you're bloodthirsty, with the president of Harvard sitting on, kind of nodding. But that the attempt at doing something like that is not to do, is maybe a little more interesting than just to say that Churchill was a flawed human being. What I'm trying to do.
But certainly nobody's going to be very surprised to learn that Hitler
nobody's going to be surprised at that. And that is, as some of the reviews have said, the knowledge that Churchill had this real fascination with bombing itself is not new knowledge. What I think is important to have put at least down chronologically is that his flawed decisions actually were a gift to Hitler's government, that they helped prop up and make worse the very regime that he was put in power to resist. And I think that is the reason that the book is so enraging to some people, because it is in a sense implying a kind of unholy collaboration between this obviously impossibly, unspeakably repellent regime in Europe, in on the continent, and this resistor.
It is. It's a very unsettling argument, not simply because it reminds us of the morally ambiguous things we, again in quotes, did on the Allied side, but also because it does build up quite strongly to the suggestion that going to war at all with the Nazis was a bad idea.
And the idea is to rescue the voices of some of the people who were saying that at the time. We can now say it, and I think it's legitimate to say something like that now. It was a lot harder for Vera Brittain to say it in a published form, knowing that she was going to be not just reviled for it, but that the Peace Pledge Union, the printers and all that, were in trouble with the government. So what she said is, I've been to a speech that Hitler gave. I saw him and that kind of fanatic, paranoid rhetoric. And she said, clinicians know what wouldn't work with a man like this. Obviously, reciprocal violence is going to be the least effective measure to use against someone like this. She said it at the time, and it seems useful to lift her. Obviously, it was unsuccessful voice. She was a voice of moderation at the time. It didn't work. But now it's useful to know that there were people saying that kind of thing in public then.
Yes, although many people would question that it was really an option for the Allied powers to avoid war with Hitler.
Well, you can sort of lay out a whole range of possibilities, can't you? You can be a complete, absolute pacifist, almost a cheerful self-sacrificer like Gandhi. And I think the kind of language he uses sometimes is very disturbingly upbeat about the massive sacrifice that of his people.
Yes,
right?
Very quietist, isn't it?
And then you can be an old-fashioned militarist and still take exception to the particular strategy that Britain employed, the strategy of deliberately of choosing a very long, low-intensity war, a war in which you say we will come to the defense of Poland and then do absolutely nothing except tiny bombing raids on the coast, right? And then you can, and then because you're massively building more bombers so that you'll be ready for the big attack.
Although with the trenches still very much living memory, actually carrying the country with you into a ground war would have been extremely difficult. Right. It was only became possible after a long, a lot more manpower coming in from the troops coming in from the States,
right,
and already
right,
weariness with the bombing campaign.
And
I
think Churchill was uppermost in his mind was the horrors of the there was. I think he told Hopkins in a quote that I use in the book that this was never going to be a war of large armies hurling themselves at each other, trenches. That was a horrible paralysis that he was going to avoid. He was going to fly over any trenches and attack Germany at what he called its tap root. And he also, I think, from the beginning expected, he even said this in 38, that the next war, he said, would be a war in which the enemy attacked British cities. And when this cowardly method was employed, British manhood would be roused to action. So what he wanted to do, what he was clearly doing, in fact, was waiting for the annihilating counterattack. He wanted the Luftwaffe to come over, and he knew that when that happened, it would be possible to then raise the large army.
What will disturb, I would imagine, a majority of readers and upset them is the Holocaust was more or less brought on by the way in which the Allies fought the war in terms of the food blockade and the bombings of German housing and so on.
Well, I think you have to be very careful about a word like brought on, because what you have to say about something
it accelerated the logic of Nazi anti-Semitism.
Yes,
exaggerated it.
One of the few sort of historians that I actually quote in the book is Shlomo Aronson, who said that the British bombing campaign united the German nation behind Hitler and accelerated. And I think he said it heightened his own, obviously paranoid, notion of a Jews' war. This was a creation of the Nazi fantasy factory, that this whole thing, this whole massive war that they had obviously started, was actually, in their imaginations, a war of the Jews against them. So then, given this whole kind of real paranoid construction, if you then put an umbrella over that of a war in which things are blown up and people's lives are being destroyed and everything is confused and the result will be a kind of violence, a releasing of antipathy, an ungovernable kind of national enlistment and radicalization of what was just sort of floating around as a fantasy. That's the implication of the book. But
people will argue, though, that that was implicit in the whole logic of fascism, and whether it was accelerated by the Second World War or not is a somewhat academic. Particularly as if you also disagree with the contention of your book, or the implicit argument of your book, that any kind of negotiated settlement with Hitler was possible. That had been tried before, but you do remind people of what Hitler presented as a plan for a negotiated peace.
Yes, I think you have to quote Hitler's own peace proposals, his one called A Final Appeal to Reason. This is a man that we object to, that we don't trust, that we dislike profoundly. Does that mean that you don't negotiate? I think it's not an academic distinction to say that in the war, people were actually dying, and in 1925, Hitler was fantasizing about the extermination of a race. I think that he was talking about the destruction of the Jewish race in Europe from the very beginning. It's obviously the cornerstone of his entire outlook on life. But what takes that fundamental, mentally ill fantasy and allows a man like that to carry it out with a nation of bureaucrats behind him? I think the only thing that allows it to be carried out is the kind of stresses of a war.
For more discussion and analysis, download Guardian Daily. That's the Guardian's news podcast, available first thing in the morning, Monday to Friday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.